On our last occasion, my friend Gordon Smith raised the problem of accident, and I said there isn't any. And of course everybody believes that there is. So I want to examine this rather carefully, because we tend to think there are accidents happening all around us every day. 100 motor cars driving at 80 miles an hour in the fog have an accident, a pile-up. Wonderful coincidence of accidents. I want to go back to the fundamental idea, dualism is impossible. You remember our proof of that? I don't need a volunteer to stand up and tell us, do I? What proves the impossibility of dualism? Because I don't need anyone to tell us, I'll ask Greta to do it. Greta, why is dualism impossible?
God is not two.
That's a statement, that's not a proof.
Well, it's what I'm saying.
Oh.
You can't. Why?
That's what I like about help.
You can't have a dualism.
No? Why not?
If God is one, and he isn't even one, if God is all, there isn't anything else but that, so there can't be two.
That's an if. You said if.
So, that is it.
That is it. That's in the proof. That's a dogmatic statement.
Yes, it is.
Can I have a proof? Oh, another volunteer.
If we were separate, I wouldn't be able to hear you.
That's a better proof, isn't
yes,
it? Let's extend that universally. If there were more than one basic reality, they would have to be absolutely unlike each other in order to maintain their difference. And if they were absolutely unlike, they could not communicate. Right? Absolute unlikes cannot intercommunicate. So there's our proof. Absolute unlikes cannot be conceived to be able to communicate. To communicate, they must have something in common. Now, as human beings, we have two weird facts. One is the fact of our physicality, and the other is the fact of our ability to manipulate our physicality. We have consciousness, whereby we are aware of our mental process, our emotive process, our physical process. And we have the physical fact that is very hard to get rid of. It imposes itself on us. Now, absolute unlikes cannot interact, but our volition, our feeling, our thought interacts with our body. That means the body and consciousness cannot be fundamentally different. Right? Consciousness and physicality cannot be fundamentally different. That is why we say that consciousness is a catalyst. Consciousness precipitates the world. Now let's examine this in relation to the idea of an accident. If dualism is impossible, then whatever happens must be caused by the ultimate non-dual reality. There cannot be an event that is not caused. And when we are talking about accident, what are we talking about? The word means something that falls to us, just falls. Nothing causative relation. Accident means two falling. Something falls. With no causal relation. A pot of paint in the hand of man on top of the ladder. The man on top of the ladder, not looking what he's doing, spill some of the paint. The man underneath receives the paint. The paint falls on the man. The man on whom the paint falls considers it to be an accident. It has fallen on him, and there's no causal relation between the man on the ladder, the paint, and the recipient of the paint.
But there is, surely.
Not if you believe in accident. Now, the man on the ladder, we did mention, he's a bit annoyed about being up the ladder anyway. Mm. If he sees a well-dressed man going underneath with a 200-pound jacket on, well, then he deserves spotting a bit. Now, if the ultimate reality is non-dual, then sentience and matter are not ultimately different. Everything that happens physically has another aspect to it, the aspect of consciousness, the aspect of intention, the aspect of volition. And we tend to hope that this isn't true. We tend to hope that there are accidents. Now, why do we like to think that accidents exist?
So that you can pass the buck.
Because the alternative is continuous watchfulness about the situation's possibilities. Now, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Who likes that one? Not many. We occasionally hear it out of the mouths of drunken politicians.
The only way you'll be alive.
The only way you can guarantee, because guarantee means will. The goo guarantee means will. Goo aranti means will. Now, let us accept non-dualism. Therefore, nothing whatever is absolutely disconnected from anything else. Now, the cause, said Caesar, is in my will. The concept of cause is a blow struck. That word cause, for your dictionary owners, means a blow struck. That blow is an act of initiative. If non-dualism is true, then an act of will must affect total reality. Now, wherever there is a condensation of that field of power, that sentient power that we call God, wherever there is a condensation of it, there is a will to individuation. The fact that our organs, we've all got to more or less stomachs, hearts, lungs, in some condition or other. And therefore we have something in common with each other, similar organs. But are our pulse rates identical? Is our digestive rate identical? Do we deal with the same miraculously non-expensive slimming diet identically? No. So, although we have many, many things apparently similar, like stomachs and hearts and eyeballs and things, they don't operate identically. They are not under an overriding super control that makes them behave the way they behave. Somehow they are self-determined. Let's think about the word self with a capital S and with a small s. Now, with a capital S, the S means infinite spirit. S has always been a glyph of a serpent. Our letter S derives from a drawing of a snake. And that snake symbolizes free, undulatory, intelligent motion. And when this motion goes about in infinity, it can either cross itself or not. It can do what is called meander, or it can translate from place to place, or rotate or vibrate. It will translate, rotate, vibrate. But these are limiting factors to the possibility of types of motion. Now let's look at the word meander. Me and all you German scholars, like Abel, for instance. Abel, what does ander mean in German?
Other.
Means other. That's not an accident, it's a fact. The ander means, an means snake, running. An, name Anna, means snake, on the run, not rotating snake. On, O-N, is rotating snake. An is a running snake, a snake that oscillates from side to side but does not close on itself. So ander means a running snake, and the snake is the type of sensuous, self-satisfying pursuer. And the D-E-R means discriminative activity. So ander, meaning otherness, means a travelling force, sentient force, which is discriminating in going along. The snake goes to the right, changes its mind, goes to the left, changes its mind, goes to the right. It's oscillating while it goes along. In the process, it is vibrating. And this is the meaning of the der in the ander. So ander, other, is very important. It means discriminating to avoid being locked up. Now, meandering is obvious. It's an objective state, M for the substance, E for the triple life. Me, you can all say that word. When you say it, you are saying substantial trine life, a threefold life substance. Meandering is me avoiding committal. Now, if I said me on, that would not be avoiding committal, because the O-N means serpent with tail in mouth. Self-committal to self-development is onder. You use the same word for a waveform, don't you, in French, in the bass. Is there a French female in the house that knows how to say waveform in French? Is there one? How do you say that weird little entity that is both a wave and a particle? What is it? That's not French, is it? Isn't Hanukkah in the house? Pardon? Good. That's a confession. That's usually true without the confession. What do you call a particle and a wave together in French? Particle. Well, the onde part is the wave, which is funny, isn't it? Because you'd expect the opposite. The an is the running serpent, but when he gets his tail in his mouth, it becomes on. And that is the base of the French for wave. Now, light behaves in both particular and wave form, which is very peculiar. But we also behave in the same way. There is only one law, absolute, the Torah of the Hebrews, the Tariqah of the Muslims, same base, same word, one law and one only. We either commit ourselves or we do not. To commit is to bind ourselves to a certain kind of activity, and to dodge that is to meander. To other oneself. Now the difference between God, which is the infinite absolute, and the creature is this. The infinite absolute is utterly void of otherness. There is no otherness there. Otherness belongs to the finite created being. When you say he is bothered, bother means be other than. To be bothered is to be othered. It is to have inside us, quite simply, more than one. Now, when you say God is one, you're saying he's not othering. Whatever he wills to commit himself to, that he does. Purity of heart is to will one thing. More than one thing is othering and bothering oneself. Now, if there is only one will, in its purity, like the will of the Absolute, there can be no accident there, because everything that occurs, occurs because it is willed, purely. And the Absolute is infinite, and infinity has nothing outside it that could interfere with its activity. The Absolute, infinite, is the only absolutely free motion. And it remains free unless it binds itself by a self-committal. It's got to turn an, the running serpent, into on, the self-binding, rotating serpent. The serpent is a symbol of sensuous motion. Sensuous motion can go around without committal, or it can commit itself to objective existence in order to experience the pleasure of objectivity, which is apparently a type of security. Now imagine in the Absolute Infinite there can be no accident because nothing exists other than it to befall it. So absolutely there is no accident or possibility of it. There is only the absolute will, self-determinant in every way. Now it says about man in the Great Book that he is made in the image of God, in consequence of which he has three things: intelligence, will, and speech. Intelligence is what we call sentience. Will is initiative, and speech, you know, it's the power to express what your intelligence and will motivate themselves by. Intelligence, will, speech. And when we do not verbalize what we're doing, when we do not speak, we're not terribly clear about what we're doing. So we could talk about a baby before it's born, when it's sitting in the womb and has not yet learned to articulate words. We'll call that baby in its pre-verbal state. So it cannot speak in our sense of the term. It may hear its mother speaking, because the voice of the mother vibrates through the amniotic fluid, affects the hearing apparatus of the child, and the child hears noises, but they're very muffled through the body processes through which they come, and they're not clearly articulate. Yet we know by prenatal research that nevertheless the babies do record things said whilst the baby is in the womb, but they're not clearly recorded. If we pay attention very carefully, we will find that we can actually recover things said by the mother or the father in debate or separately from the child, from a prenatal condition. But not until the baby is born and breathes and takes the air and lets it out and then manipulates its tongue and lips in certain ways does it gain what we call articulate speech. Now it's got intelligence and it's got will, but until it's born and starts to manipulate its tongue and lips, it does not articulate. But when it begins to do so, it does a terrible thing on itself. In the act of acquiring the terms from its mother or father or both, or its educators, teachers, and governmental propaganda, as it does so, it begins to focus on the terminology and to become subordinate to the words. Hence the statement, to speak is to fall. When you speak, that's the word speech. How do you spell speech? With a double E-C-H. How do you spell speak? With an E-A-K. You're locking up your fundamental life activity. The E is the triple form of life. The A is the activity. The K is the locking. So to speak is the spiritual power, serpentine sensuality, posting itself in a triple activity locked up. To speak is to fall. Now, babies do not get much opportunity to not speak. They're battered by parents and put great faces into prams and say goo goo goo, and wonderful primal sounds, and they persuade by all kinds of trickery the baby to acquire vocabulary. And the vocabulary is a voice book collection. of willful affirmations. It's a vocabulary. A voice, will, collection, affirmation. The baby accepts the terms for its own ends, bends them to the best of its ability, misunderstands its mother or other teacher, and tries valiantly to avoid the committal that the parents and teachers are trying to impose upon it. But there is no accident here. There's nothing non-causally falling to the child. The will of the parents to make this child articulate, the will of the teachers to make it obedient, the will of the government to reduce it to the level of citizen. These are wills, they are not accidents. Now there is nothing in our non-dual universe that is not caused by intelligent will. Now the speaking is there in the universe. Prior to the creation of the world that we know as gross material, there is already primordial sound. Now you know the definition of sound in physics. It's an alternation of compression and decompression. The atmosphere is compressed, then released, and compressed and released. It makes a noise like clapping. That definition of sound covers every noise that everything whatever makes. And as everything in the universe is vibrating, there is no such thing as an absolutely silent being. Now if I hold my hands flat like this and hit them, that makes a certain kind of noise. And if I curve them and do this, it makes another noise. That one said slap and that one said slop. If you listen carefully, you will hear the vowel changes. Now everything in the universe is vibrating in a characteristic way determined by the structure of that thing. Structure is the form way. That's one structure, and that's another structure. Structure is stricture, restraint. Nothing in the universe can exist without vibrating, and without rotating, and without translating. Three characteristic motions in everything. And this vibratory behavior is sound. And therefore the ancients wisely said that the fundamental power, causative of all things, is primordial sound. In India you would call that Shabda. In Greek you call it Logos. We call it cosmic reason, cosmic intellect. But it means quite simply this, that there is a closure, symbolized by Saturn, and a release, symbolized by Jupiter, and an alternation of those two, and this causes a spin or rotation, encapsulation or ensphering, and production of beings. Now to be is from the letter B, which is a labial plosive, You make a sphere in your mouth to pronounce B, and suddenly release it from the lips. And when that occurs, you have demonstrated the very process whereby the universe comes into being. Being meaning encapsulation. Now, as soon as encapsulation occurs, there is committal of a definite amount of sentient power to that condition of encapsulation, that is to being. And as soon as being comes into existence, then there is a possibility of contingent relation. There is one being, there is another being, and they can strike on each other. And it's here where arises the concept of accident. One sphere and another, A and B. They're going along. We say the A state is prior to the B, A counted for B. A is absolute and B is being. Outside every sphere there is the absolute infinite, and the absolute infinite can knock upon the ensphered condition we call being. A for the absolute, B for being. The power outside in a spherical form can knock on the walls of the sphere. Now, from the point of view of the ensphered sent him power, he may have had no warning that this knock was coming. This is very important, because that sphere could be surprised and would call the knocking on his wall accidental. The B being encapsulated does not know that the absolute outside it can and may and probably will knock upon the sphere. Now the sphere is ignorant of the absolute. Ignorant means willfully disregarding. In order to be and continue in being, you must disregard the condition of the absolute. But if you think about the absolute, you probably let go of your being. You can all do that for 3 seconds to prove the point. Please all think of the absolute, non-being. Done it? What have you got? No thing. But if there is no thing, which is the infinite absolute, can you predict it? No. You cannot predict the behavior of an infinite power which is not in the condition we call being. If you cannot predict it, whatever it does you call accidental, because it befalls you. But is it accidental from the point of view of the absolute? No. The absolute wills to push these spheres, which it has generated within itself, to push these spheres around without bothering to consult them. And they will interpret this, if unpleasant, it's an accident. But from the absolute point of view, there is no accident. But from the point of view of an ensphered zone of ignorance, there is an accident. Namely, whatever happens to it is an accident. So we could say, if we wish to avoid so-called accident, we must start to cease to be unconscious. We must stop being disregardant. We must stop being ignorant that the absolute is really with us. There's an Islamic saying that says, when you are living, live as if you can see God in everything. And if you can't see him, nevertheless he sees you. Now imagine you are all living and breathing and doing the best you can with what you've got. And you forget that actually your very body is a precipitate of an infinite sentient power which is called God. And although you may forget God, he doesn't forget you. Because if the absolute sentient power forgot you, you would cease to exist. You exist in virtue only of the centripetal focus upon you of the absolute. The absolute is focusing on us individually. And when it ceases to, we die. We disintegrate. Did any of you see a marvelous film about slime molds? Oh, somebody did. That was good. And you saw a perfect example there of the ignorance of the scientist. He was very, very interested. But like the other scientists investigating the same phenomenon, he had no idea what was happening. He thought that they ought to seek the cause of the slime molds break up and reassembling. Now, when there's food in the environment, this massive slime, like a slug, breaks into little bits, individuals, and each individual goes around and eats whatever it individually finds. But when they've cleared a given environment of food, they all go back together and they make one lovely slug, which goes about like one being. Microphotography there was wonderful. We go about exactly like one being, with the front end, like a nosy bit. And they've forgotten all their differences. They're just like the Mongol hordes coming out of the Asiatic plains. Same thing happened to them exactly. Namely, when there was a lot of food in their environment, they just stayed there and ate it. And when it became deficient, they got together and invaded Europe and frightened hell out of everybody. And there is still nervousness in the Russians today in case they come back. and they behaved exactly like the slime mills. When there's plenty to eat for all of us at a party, we don't snatch custards out of each other's mouths. But if the food is deficient, short, lacking, you'll see eyes shining. And sidling, apparently accidentally, towards the best éclair. The same thing for the human being and occurs for the slime mill, because there is only one law. Now, insofar as we know that a fully conscious being is not ignorant, that is not willfully disregardant of anything whatever, for that being there are no accidents. Now, if there are no accidents, truly, obviously the best thing for us to do is become as conscious as we can of as many things as we can, because the more we're aware of possibilities, the less accident will happen to us, because an accident is merely a misinterpretation of the event. As long as we know that every act is caused ultimately by the Absolute Infinite, and we adjust to that and remain awake, we are relatively free from accident. Now, Western philosophy is a bit dull-witted, but the best of it has borrowed from certain Oriental sources, mainly Asiatic, certain concepts, and the basic concept of all was a religious concept which divided reality into two kinds: absolute reality and relative reality. Absolute reality with a big R, absolute reality, capital A, capital R. That means the absolute itself is differentiating itself. But the small one, the relative, is two R's, relative reality. That means that the already broken up by the absolute is further broken up by individual beings that have come to be by the will of the Absolute. That infinite Absolute, which we call God, differentiates the universe, and we are a product of the differentiation. Now, if we accept the differentiation willed by the Absolute, then we are true children of God. We accept what is happening differentially. But if we then decide to be extra clever and differentiate the already differentiated in ever new ways, we complicate our lives more than we need and become progressively more and more subject to accident. Are we agreed that the distinction between the absolute and the relative is valid? The absolute has no otherness. The relative is all otherness. Now, as long as we're in the realm of otherness, we are battered by a multitude of stimuli, all of which tend to disrupt us, to break us into pieces, to destroy our fundamental unity. Now, you know our word for unity is one, isn't it? O-N-E, that's three letters. And we know there are three letters in the French and the Italian and the German and various other languages, three letters in the Hebrew, the account for one. And what does it mean? It means that every one is three. What are they three? Force, form, function. There is no being that is not triple F. Force, form, function. Make a diagram of triple F by simply drawing a circle, and then from the centre draw three legs at equidistant, like the Manx three legs, and then turn each one of those radius lines into an F by putting two little marks going out from its side. You've now drawn a primal symbol of great power, which if you wear it to remind you, make a note of it in your book, and make another note in your mind, so that whenever you look at anything whatever, you see triple F, force, form, function. You never think that another being is other than that triple. You never think there is a being which has form without function and without force. You never think there is a force with no form and no function. You never think there is a function with no force and no form. That means that when you're looking at another human being, in order to relate to that being, you are required by your own intelligence to see force, form, function. Now, if you cannot get immediately its own way by force, what does it do? Change form and function. But if we fall into forgetfulness, we become lethargic, we drink of the waters of Lethe, and we forget that other people are actually triple. They are force, form, function beings. That anything that we do to them with our force, our form, our function, they have a response that they can make. And it may be that they don't make it externally visible. They can have a force response, that's a will that doesn't agree with yours. They can have a form response, that's an idea that doesn't agree with yours. And they can have a function response, namely they can do something that you didn't expect. There are no beings from the most rudimentary amoeba, monocell, to the highest and most complex human genius that are not force, form, function beings. Now, as every act that is willed is not an accident, and dualism is impossible, the infinite is a triple. The infinite is force and form and function. And that is the meaning of that word logos. Now, when you write an L, that means light. When you write the G, that means dark, the body. Consciousness and the body, L and G, lambda and gamma. And when you write the S, that is the outflowing function. So the word logos actually means force, form, function. Where the force is the lambda, is the consciousness. You're at your most powerful where you are most conscious. You're most vulnerable where you're unconscious. So the force is equated with the letter L there, which means light, which means consciousness, which is rather strange, because you don't think much of consciousness as force. You just tend to think it's a kind of mental enlightenment, but you don't realize it's force, because everywhere you go in your mind with consciousness, you change by the fact of consciousness, the function of your ideas. So we say consciousness is a catalyst. Now a catalyst is something that the presence of which causes other things to change, but itself remains what it is. Consciousness causes changes of idea and activity, of form and function. But that consciousness does not cease to be consciousness. It remains exactly what it is. Consciousness is eternally what it is. Now the function is temporarily changing, but the cause of it, namely the consciousness, is the real power. And the form that it wills by focusing to come to be is the idea that governs the activity. Now, is there anybody here who believes that there is an accident in the ordinary sense of the word? If there is, tell me. I'd like to discuss it from that particular aspect. Does anybody at all believe that there is an accident in the ordinary sense of the term? An uncaused event that just occurs out of the blue.
And then you say that the absolute is that there is no otherness in the absolute, and then I said it's all otherness.
Yes.
How then can there be communication between the absolute and the relative
That's perfectly easy. Otherness is a function of the absolute. All that you call otherness is differential function, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yes. The otherness is the absolute othering. Without altering its absoluteness. Not in any way, no. Supposing I wave my hand like this. Now, is that hand waving the same as or different from that indication? Is that indication identical with this? It's the same. Therefore, we talk about dialectics. Now, dialectics has a certain pair of opposites of anything whatever. Never accept one of a pair of opposites as determinant. Othering is the way the absolute produces the universe. God says, I was a hidden treasure. I desired to be known. Therefore, I created the world. A hidden treasure meant to say, he was infinitely capable of othering himself. But if he didn't other, he was hidden. Tremendous treasure. Now, treasure means tree assure. Triple assurance. Fourth form function. When you're not using them, when you're in deep sleep, you get the nearest to it. Deep, dreamless sleep. You're not othering, are you? You're not aware of your othering. You think you might be othering on the quiet? You might, but what is it to you if you don't know about it? Aren't you a hidden treasure? There you are, lying in bed, snoring. Oh no, that would be othering, quietly. You are full of relational possibilities, and you're asleep. Have you ever seen a beautiful male asleep? Not breathing noisily. Have you? That made you laugh. Have you seen one? Imagine the sleeping beauty, not dreaming. Therefore, not othering. But if you woke it up, it could do something interesting. It gives a nudge at 3 a.m. and it wakes up and starts othering. Yes? And what would it be like if you didn't give it the nudge and it didn't wake up and it didn't other? Nor did you. Nor did anyone else. There would be no else. What kind of reality could it be with no othering in it? Can you tell me? Can anybody describe for me the condition of absolute non-otheringness? Boredom. That sounds like a masculine analysis, yeah. Boredom. There is a dome or situation waiting to be bored. Man auger. Who wishes to do a bit of augury. Yes? When there's nothing to bore into, what do you feel like, Trevor?
Restless.
Restless. You mean your boring implement is not othering itself, isn't it? Isn't that strange? There's only one law. There's no other law. It's called always the same name and disguised in different ways in different languages. Nevertheless, it is only one law. It's the law of the triple force form function. Because you can't have a force, by definition, that doesn't form itself and function. And you can't have a function that is not a formed force. And you can't have a form that is not a forcing function. So that's one law, which is three. That's why one of our English poets said, in terrible disgust, I think it was Coleridge actually, he said, I don't like that fellow, he's otherwise intelligent, but the damn fellow's a Unitarian, you know. He's Unitarian, he can't grasp the Trinity. Thinking there is only one, not three. And we cannot think about one without three. Because whatever we think of is a force, form, function. And in it there is no room whatever for accident of any kind. There's plenty of room for ignorance, misinterpreting events as accidents, like the men in the motors and the fog on the motorway. It's an accident. A woman came to see me in 20 minutes, and that 20 minutes normally occupied 50 minutes coming from the other side of Blackpool. And it was thick fog. It was amazing she arrived at all. But she came in a very large Mercedes. I'm so glad to be out of the fog. I had it out because it's so dangerous to be in fog. That was serious. She had it out because it was dangerous to be in fog. Get out of it as quickly as possible. Was that an accident? No, no, I think she bore a charmed life. Have we done enough about non-accident as a possibility now? Because if we have, we can go on to private purpose. Can we go on to private purpose now?
Could I just ask you something?
Yes?
You were saying that if you have two things that were completely and utterly different,
yes,
that they couldn't communicate,
right,
and that was a proof that there wasn't duality.
Yes.
But just because they couldn't communicate, does that preclude their separate existence?
It precludes you knowing about such a separate existence. And what you cannot know about for you is a non-entity.
So it's really irrelevant then,
rather than... Oh, it's irrelevant.
...that they
don't exist. And it's the proof that they don't exist. Because to exist is always to an observer. When we say existence, we're talking about something perceived. You know Bishop Berkeley's statement, don't you? Esse est percipi. To be is to be perceived. So the actual absolute power, which we call God, when he focuses to perceive, he produces the thing that he focuses. It wasn't there until he focused. Now we use the definition of faith. The power to put your foot down where nothing is, and in the act of putting it down, posit something to put it on. That's power. Consciousness itself posits its own object. First it makes idea, then it drives into the idea, that's emotional charge, and then it drives into that, and it becomes an object. Idea, emotion, act. Idea, emotion, act. Again, a trinity. Right? That's all right. Good.
Because sometimes when you say the word accident, can you relate that to speaking being vibrational?
Yeah.
Writing, which is dented.
Yeah.
Is the CI then the consciousness in between? The act is the vibration first. The CI is...
You mean in an accident?
Yes.
And if you do this, put it CID, because it comes from cadere, to fall. And you know what a cad is, don't you?
Yeah.
What's a cad?
Cad was, well, it was a person who was, if I'm thinking of the right cad, it could be many cads, couldn't there? Cad was a person who was not a gentleman.
Not a gentleman.
Yeah.
Well, actually, inherently, to be a cad is to be a cadent member of a family, and if he weren't because there were so many other members of the same family, he might be near the throne. And as he fell away from the possibility of getting on the throne, because there's a many between, he was called cadent or a cad. And the behaviour of a man who was absolutely certain he was too far away to get on the throne was far worse than the one who was the immediate claimant to the throne. Absolute cad. You know, when our word private, yes, and the word privated, diminished, robbed, have the same root. Now, private is pira, beat. Going according to spin. Now, remember, you have an, the running serpent, and on, serpent with tail in mouth. Now, the serpent with tail in mouth on is a pi-ra function. That is pi ratio. You all know what pi ratio is, don't you? What is it? 3.1416, etc., etc., etc. It's the ratio of the radius to the circumference, isn't it?
Yeah.
And without the circumference, you couldn't have pi ratio. And without the circumference or in sphering, you could not have pi-ra bhakti purpose. Because private means to go in the manner of in sphering. And therefore, as a separative individual. Now surely private purpose is about the most dim-witted thing anybody could have. And therefore all the great religions say, do away with private purpose. Don't have private purpose. Have universal purpose. If you're going to do any good, do it to as many people as you can do it to. But for God's sake, be surreptitious about it. Jesus says, don't pray loudly in public. They'll bash you. Who the hell does he think he is praying for me? And your shins are in danger. You know, shins have got nails in, especially to make them painful. Mm. It should stop you running about carelessly, actually. We have positive nerves in the shin bone. And it should be called shin bone, really. But it's called shin bone because you shine with realization. Have you ever run into a low cast iron railing with a shin bone? The enlightenment. Yeah? That's called shin or shine bone. Shining to appear, you see. Things appear on the sharp pains that don't appear. And that's a warning against sensual submission to seduction. If your eyes have to be stroked so that your consciousness is reduced, your vulnerability increases as consciousness decreases. Now, private means quite simply, you draw a line around you, physically, mentally, emotionally, and believe, most stupidly, that no one else knows what you're up to. You think everybody else is stupid, that they're not watching you, that they haven't rumbled your purpose. And actually, everybody's watching everybody all the time, with different degrees of efficiency. But nevertheless, watching. So private purpose is a very good way of increasing accident probability for oneself. The more private the purpose, the more ignorant one is of other people's purposes. Because to be private in your own is to focus, to concentrate, and to concentrate is to deprive yourself of information beyond your zone of being. If you're so preoccupied with you and your experiences, you haven't enough energy left to watch everybody else's experience. So private purpose deprives you of the consciousness that would, if you had it, make you efficient in the pursuit of your private purpose. So private purpose is a dialectical self-defeating. So the private purpose and accident are related very intimately. Accident increases as private purpose increases. I'm in a hurry. I'm going out. It's foggy. But I'm in a hurry. I'm going out. I've got an appointment. It's private. I could ring up and say, sorry, it's foggy, can't come. But if my private purpose is so strong that it forces me out, and I mean forces, compels me out into the fog, and I hurry up like mad because I'm in the fog and it's dangerous, and I want to get to the beloved before I get killed, then I hope the beloved has got me insured. There's not terribly much one can say about private purpose other than this. It is abysmally stupid. It is condemned by all the major religions without exception. And religions are not the inventions of idiots. They are the products of very, very sensitive beings who have observed the human race and how it defeats itself and have made rules out of the observed self-defeating of egotism. All the founders of all the religions have observed the same thing, like he says about Jesus. He knew what was in man, therefore he did not trust him. on that account, he didn't begin to believe in man, because he knew what was in man, namely stupidity, negligence, selfishness, private purpose, indifference, disregard for other people. Now, with a few million of those, there's bound to be trouble. In an ant colony, you don't find the same thing. You find marvelous cooperation. Some ants want to get from that side of a stream to that. They'll climb up a tree, swing, make a bridge of ants, and then the others climb over that bridge. How would you like to hang there, being a bridge? Walked on by the others. Ants don't mind. Why do human beings mind? They have a row. They say, you be the rope, I'll walk over you. No, it's your turn to be the rope. I was the rope last time. No, you weren't. You're lying. You never were the rope. You've done it every time. You've done it.
But vocabulary, isn't it? Ants don't have that vocabulary.
They have a vocabulary of very subtle smells.
Yes.
Called aromatherapy. This is another example of the private purpose of human beings. Human beings are so privately stupefied that they actually think that animals have got no sense. You know, they think that man is superior to animals, don't they? I was watching a weaver bird program last week, and the male bird builds a perfect nest, spherical nest, with a hole in the bottom so the rain doesn't go like this. And it worked very, very hard with the straws, and it made a lovely nest, and then it stood outside and went like that. That was called the display. And the girl has been doing nothing, sitting on the branch watching him. When he'd finished, she went to it, went inside and came out and then tore it to pieces. Rotten weaving. And he immediately went, if he doesn't make that nest, he won't perpetuate himself through his children. If she doesn't like it, she'll take it to pieces. Now, have you seen anything cleverer than that in the human race? No. That's why it says in the Quran, very clearly, man's stupidity is so great he cannot see the intelligent demonstration amongst their animals. That animals are intelligent in their way. And their intelligence comes from the same place that man's intelligence comes from, namely the absolute. But we, through vocabulary complications of our own, and particularly through telling lies to ourselves, have come to believe that we are the very reason of existence. We're not. If we misuse the animal world, the vegetable world, the mineral world, it will degenerate, it will corrupt, and we'll kill ourselves. What? No salmon in the Scottish rivers? Somebody's pinched them. No clear atmosphere? No rain without acid? Who's doing it? The ants? The bees? No. The clever ones are doing it. Now the whole thing is, in all major religions, there's only one religion. You call it Torah, you can call it Rota, you can call it Wheel, you can call it Being, you can call it Logos, you can call it Triumph of Yang in the End, call it what you like. There is one law, the law of force, form, function, the law of consciousness, of idea, of activation, the law of precipitation by acts of will. That is the only law there is. Now, because the ultimate reality is a continuum, it follows, logically, that that continuum must have whatever it's got distributed throughout itself. A continuum has no parts, so that whatever is in it anywhere is in it everywhere. Now, if there can occur anywhere, whatever, within that infinite field of sentient power, a single precipitate of one dot, one yod, one little letter, one anywhere, then by the law of the continuum, such can reproduce everywhere. Every point of precipitation in the field presupposes that any other part of the field can likewise precipitate itself. That's why we said, let's use capital S and little s. Now capital S means the infinite field itself as sentient, and little s means any individual point. And let's examine the name of God in the Hebrew four-letter form. There's a yod, there's a hey, there's a vav, there's a hey. And the yod is an I, and the hey is really an aspirated E, triple, fifth letter. And it spells Yah. And the third letter is a V, or an O, or a U. And the last letter is another hey, or E, aspirate. It is saying, form, field, drive, field. Idea, field, the field is the emotional charge, and then action, field. I get an idea that I will make a fist, and I now get the idea that I will drive the fist. There's the yod, and the space around it. Observe, when I make a fist, the force in the field of my hand contracts, right? Can my hand contract without that force? Right. So, when my hand contracts like that, have I not demonstrated that a field force called extended hand contracts? Right. I make a yod, that's the contracted hand, and it was the field, which is that hey, that fifth letter, R letter E, triple. False form function. There it is. And now I'm going to change my will. Having made it like that, I will drive it through space. And that drive is the third letter. And when I drive it, am I driving it through a field? When I hold it contracted, my field is spherical. Yeah? Around the contracted fist. But when I push it through space, haven't I made my field like a tube? And the phonetic for that tube is that letter, the sixth letter above. So the name of God means yod, idea, field of idea, vav, or driving force, and field of driving force. And we put that together, it's called tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God. Get an idea, push it. Get an idea, then push it. This is the cause of all Jewish success in business. Get an idea and push it. What does a guy do? He gets an idea and he doesn't push it. Why? Because he thinks, maybe somebody else thought about it. Maybe I'm wasting my time. Maybe already the fellow is at the office taking out a patent on this idea. So he doesn't do it. Now the key to all successes, whether a Mongolian conquerors of Genghis Khan or Tamerlane, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, they get an idea and they push it. The idea is the first letter, the push is the third letter, and the second and fourth letter are the field or emotive charge, first on the idea, then on the push. Now if you then take those four letters and write them, yod, hey, or hey. You often see it in paintings by the greats, by Rembrandt and others, shining away in the back of the picture. Because it's the key to existence. The very key to existence is in that name. And we'll cut the name into two, and we'll read it anti-Hebraic, that is backwards to the way it's been written, because the Jews have already turned it round. And we now read it, H-U, H-I, a hey with a vav and a hey with a yod. But now it means he, she, he, she. When you say who, it means he. Who is the Hebrew for he? And he, H-I, is the Hebrew for she. So that mysterious four-letter name is identical in meaning with the Chinese yang yin, he and she. Now, who's doing the driving, Trevor? The female or the male?
The male.
The male. So HU, which means life drive, means he. But who's got the idea that it would be a good thing if he drove? She. You see? That's the hidden mystery of that mysterious name. It says, who, remember that's Hebrew for he, and he, that's Hebrew for she, who he made the universe, and she he made sure he made it. Now how is it the wives are the best source of inspiration to the husband? And why do they use a word that means worn out horse for what she does? It's true. And if men are not careful, they will drive all over the place, like mongrel hordes, one at a time, in all directions. Like Stephen Lincoln once said, he rode madly across the pampas in all directions. Now that's very male. Have you noticed that, ladies? I mean, there's the men will go anywhere except where they are. Have you noticed? Here, there, and everywhere. Didn't you tell me recently, John, you were going on a world tour before you did anything else?
Yes.
Did you get there?
No.
Luckily, there was a horse damager present. Me too. Now let's think about it very carefully. That nag. Do you know what a naga is in Sanskrit? It's a snake that insists on you committing yourself. Naga. Yeah? Some wonderful painters of nagas and their wives. They actually have wives. Naginis. It is the function of the female to make sure that in his rushing about, the husband that she owns shall arrive at least some of the time in the office where he swears he's been all day. Huh? And if he didn't do that, he wouldn't. He'd hang around in a pub called the town hall, I think, full of masons and things, all discussing important international affairs. Like whether Reagan did right to accept or not accept visiting a place where there were dead bodies of one-time Nazis. You know, that's a very momentous problem. I don't think we should go back to the office this afternoon. We're so well in with the landlord, he won't throw us out at closing time. True. Personally, I'm glad I don't drink. I've experimented with that. It's no good. Now let's think about that very carefully. Private purpose is the highest form of stupidity. Every religious teaching in the universe has always said so. And all the people that say they are religious have a secret private purpose, which they know is condemned by the religion they profess to follow. And what keeps them at their private purpose? A very important question.
God.
It's God that makes them stupid. Why?
So they learn more.
So they learn more. It's God that makes the prodigal. It's God that says to the prodigal, why don't you ask for your inheritance now? I mean, most people, when they inherit, have to wait for someone to die. But I, thy divine father, am immortal. If I don't die, how are you going to realize my will? So, fogged by this suggestion, the prodigal says, well, give me my money now. Okay, go, and he goes out and he finishes up with pigs. But he's got lovely stories to tell when he gets back. And God forgives all. Do you know God will forgive you the more you're stupid? Yeah? The more stupid you are, the greater the forgiveness of God. And that's a terrible problem. I've been working on it for years. How do you become deliberately stupid to make more interesting stories? The more you try, the more intelligent you get. The more intelligent you get, the harder it is to make a stupid error. It's a big twist, isn't it? And in India, the behavior of God is called Leela, sport. He creates these beings that want to exist, gives them the energy to exist, and an appearance of free will and intelligence and speech, and then says, now, get on with it. And then he watches. He's the big eagle at the top of the tree watching, with the little jackdaws on the lower branches, pecking and getting indigestion of green apples. He's very interested. This is quite serious. This is not a myth. This is the actuality of reality. Infinite intelligent power has produced individual beings, some of which are us, and drives them through hormone trickery into a state of stupidity, so that they have lots of lovely adventures and finish up very, very wise and sad. Sad is a technical term meaning spirit actively divided. Now beforehand, you see this in a baby. The baby is not divided, is it? Isn't the baby, to begin with, just one? One impulse to have its own way. If you say to the baby, what is this own way in which you want, can it tell you? No. It's just an impulse like that. Where is it from? It's from God. He inserts the drive in the innocent to make him bang his head on the doorknob. And that's part of the Rahman, Rahim. That's part of the mercy and compassion of the Absolute. How do you like it? How do you like God, the all-merciful, all-compassionate? So let's think about that, shall we, a little? You're going to think about these things. There are no accidents except to the relatively unconscious. And there is no private purpose that is not willed to be private for that person, to educate that person in more and more stupid involvements, so that eventually he can turn around and confess verily, only God is God. La ilaha illallah. There is no divine being other than the divine being. We are relative, it is absolute. And if we admit it, we become absolutely relative. Can we think about that for a little?